The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 14, Side 2.
Only 6 months later did Nedoff dare retrieve the halves. He glued them together, made a Babbitt metal cast, and sent the figure out of the camp with the help of a free man. Repeated searches for the story began in Corrective Labor Colony Number 2. A thorough inspection was made of the living area. They did not find it. One day, Nedoff decided to get his own back. He settled down after work with Tevekelyan's Granite Does Not Melt, behaving as though he was hiding something from the rest of the room. With stoolies in earshot, he asked the lads to screen him, but making sure that he could be seen through the window. The stoolies did their work quickly. Three warders ran in, while a fourth stayed outside and watched through the window, in case Nedoff passed the book to someone. They seized it. They carried it off to the warder's room and put it away in the safe. Warder Chisik, with his huge bunch of keys, arms akimbo, "We've found the book. You'll be put in the hole now." But next morning, an officer took a look. "Oh, you idiots, give it back to him." This was how the Zex read a book approved by the party and the people. In a declaration by the Soviet government, dated December 1964, we read, "The perpetrators of monstrous crimes must never and in no circumstances escape just retribution. The crimes of the fascist murderers who aimed at the destruction of whole peoples have no precedent in history." This was to prevent the Federal German Republic from introducing a statute of limitations for war criminals after 20 years had elapsed. But they show no desire to face judgment themselves, although they too aimed at the destruction of whole peoples. A lot of articles appear in our press on the importance of punishing fugitive West German criminals. There are even people who specialize in such articles. Lev Ginsberg, for instance. He writes as follows. Some say he intends us to see an analogy. "What moral training did the Nazis have to undergo for mass murder to seem natural and right to them? Now the lawgivers try to defend themselves by saying that they were not the ones to carry out the sentences, and those who did carry them out by saying that it was not they who enacted the laws. It's all so familiar. We have just read what our practical workers have to say. The custody of prisoners is a matter of carrying out the sentence of the courts. The guard did not know who was inside for what." So you should have made it your business to know, if you are human beings. That is what makes you villains, that you looked upon the people in your custody neither as fellow citizens nor as fellow men. Did not the Nazis have their instructions, too? Did not the Nazis believe that they were saving the Aryan race? Nor will our interrogators stumble over their answer. They have it pat already. Why, they ask, did prisoners make statements against themselves? In other words, they should have stood fast when we tortured them. And why did informers pass on false reports? We relied on these as though they were sworn evidence. For a short time, they became uneasy. V. N. Ilyin, the former Lieutenant General of the MGB of whom we spoke earlier, said of Stolbunovsky, General Gorbatov's interrogator, and mentioned by him, "Oh dear, dear, what an awful business it is, all these troubles he's having, and the poor fellow draws such a good pension." This is also why A. F. Zakharova took up her pen. She was worried that they might all come under attack soon. Of Captain Likoshestov, whom Deyakov had denigrated, she wrote emotionally, "He is still a captain, is secretary of a party organization, and devotes his labor to agriculture. You can imagine how difficult it is for him to work now, with people writing such things about him. There is talk of looking into Likoshestov, and perhaps even taking him to court." Putting him on trial is unthinkable, and she cannot bring herself to use the words. "What for? If it stops at talk, well and good, but it is not impossible that they will get around to it. That really will cause uproar among the MOOP personnel. Look into him for carrying out fully the instructions he was given from above. Is he now supposed to answer for those who gave the instructions? How very clever. When there's an accident, blame the switchman." But the commotion was soon over. No one would have to answer. No one would be looked into? Staffs, perhaps, were somewhat reduced in places, but have a little patience and they will expand again. Meanwhile, the security boys, those who have not yet reached pensionable age and those who need to top up their pensions, have become writers, journalists, editors, anti-religious lecturers, ideological workers, or some of them, industrial managers. They will just change their gloves and go on leading us as before. It's safer that way. And if someone is content to live on his pension, let him enjoy his ease. Take Lieutenant Colonel retired Kurdenko, for example. Lieutenant Colonel, that's quite a rank. A former battalion commander, no doubt. No, he began in 1938 as a simple screw. He used to hold the force-feeding pipe. While in the records office, they carry out a leisurely inspection and destroy all unwanted documents, lists of people shot, orders committing prisoners to solitary confinement or the disciplinary barracks, files on investigations in the camps, denunciations from stoolies, superfluous information about practical workers and convoy guards. In medical sections, accounts offices, everywhere, in fact, there are superfluous papers, unnecessary clues to be found. We take our seats at your feast like silent ghosts, and you who hated us living shall be our hosts. Living we could not move you, but speechless and dead, we are the vengeful presence you cannot but dread. Victoria G., a woman graduate of the Colima camps. A word, in passing. Why, indeed, is it always the switchmen? What about the traffic managers? What about those a little higher up than the screws, the practical workers, the interrogators, those who only pointed a finger, those who only spoke a few words from a platform? How does it go again? The perpetrators of monstrous crimes, in no circumstances, righteous retribution, have no precedent in history, aimed at the destruction of whole peoples. Shh! Now we see why, in August 1965, from the platform of the ideological conference, a closed conference on the direction our minds should take, the following proclamation was made. It is time to rehabilitate the sound and useful concept of enemy of the people. Chapter 2. Rulers change. The archipelago remains. The special camps must have been among the best-loved brain children of Stalin's old age. After so many experiments in punishment and re-education, this ripe perfection was finally born. A compact, faceless organization of numbers, not people, psychologically divorced from the motherland that bore it, having an entrance but no exit, devouring only enemies and producing only industrial goods and corpses. It is difficult to imagine the paternal pain which the visionary architect would have felt if he had witnessed in turn the bankruptcy of this great system of his. While he yet lived, it was shaken, it was giving off sparks, it was covered with cracks, but probably caution prevailed and these things were not reported to him. When the special camp system began, it was inert, sluggish, unalarming, but it underwent a rapid process of overheating, and within a few years its state was that of a boiling volcano. If the great Corypheus had lived a year or 18 months longer, it would have been impossible to conceal these explosions from him, and his weary, senile brain would have been burdened with a new decision, either to abandon his pet scheme and mix the camps again, or on the contrary to crown it by systematically shooting all the index-lettered thousands. But, amid weeping and wailing, the thinker died somewhat too soon for this. He died, and soon afterwards his frozen hand brought crashing down his still rosy-cheeked, still hale and vigorous comrade-in-arms, the minister of those extraordinarily extensive, intricate, and irresolvable internal affairs. The fall of the archipelago's boss tragically accelerated the breakdown of the special camps. What an irreparable historic mistake it was! What sense does it make to disembowel the Minister of Arcane Affairs, lay oily paws on sky-blue shoulder boards? Number patches, the supreme discovery of 20th century prison camp science, were hurriedly ripped off, thrown away, and forgotten. This alone was enough to rob the special camps of their austere uniformity. It hardly mattered when the bars had also been removed from hut windows and locks from hut doors, so that the special camps had lost the pleasant jail-like peculiarities which distinguished them from corrective labour camps. Perhaps they needn't have hurried with the bars, but they couldn't afford to be late either. In times like those, it's best to show where you stand. Sad though it was, the stone jailhouse at Ekibastutz, which had held out against the rebels, was now pulled down, razed, quite officially. And we were denied the possibility of opening a museum there in the '80s. But what could you expect if they could suddenly release to a man the Austrian, Hungarian, Polish, and Romanian prisoners in special camps, showing scant concern for their black crimes and their 15 or 20 year terms of imprisonment, and so undermine altogether the prisoners' awe of heavy sentences? They also lifted restrictions on correspondence, which more than anything had made prisoners in special camps really feel buried alive. They even allowed visits. Dreadful thought. Visits. Even in mutinous Kangir, they began building separate little houses for this purpose. The tide of liberalism swept on so irresistibly over the erstwhile special camps that prisoners were allowed to choose their own hairstyles, and aluminum dishes started vanishing from the kitchens for conversion into aluminum combs. Instead of credit accounts, instead of special camp coupons, the natives were allowed to handle ordinary Soviet currency and settle their bills with cash like people outside. Carelessly, recklessly, they demolished the system which had fed them, the system which they had spent decades weaving and binding and lashing together. And were those hardened criminals at all mollified by this pampering? They were not. On the contrary, they showed their depravity and ingratitude by adopting the profoundly inappropriate, offensive, and nonsensical word, barrierites. And now, whenever something upset them, they would yell this insult at conscientious convoy guards, long-suffering warders, and their solicitous guardians, the camp chiefs. Not only did the word pain the tender-hearted, practical workers, it could even be dangerous so soon after barriers fall, because someone might make it the starting point of an accusation. For this reason, the head of one of the Kangir camp divisions, by then purged of mutineers and replenished with prisoners from Ekibastutz, was compelled to deliver the following address from the platform. Men, in those few short years from 1954 to 56, they found it possible to call the prisoners men. You hurt the feelings of the supervisory staff and the convoy troops by shouting barrierites at them. Please stop it. To which the diminutive V.G. Vlazov replied, Your feelings have been hurt in the last few months, but I've heard nothing but fascist from your guards for 18 years. Do you think we have no feelings? And so the major promised to cut out the abusive word, fascist. A fair trade. After all these pernicious and destructive reforms, we may consider the separate history of the special camps concluded in 1954, and need no longer distinguish them from corrective labor camps. Throughout the topsy-turvy archipelago, easier times set in from 1954 and lasted till 1956, an era of unprecedented indulgences, perhaps the period of greatest freedom in its history, if we disregard the BDZs, detention centres for non-professional criminals, in the mid-20s. Instruction capped instruction. Inspector vied with inspector, encouraging ever wilder displays of liberalism in the camps. Permission for the use of female labour in the forests was withdrawn. Yes, it was acknowledged that lumbering was perhaps excessively heavy work for women, although 30 years of continual use were the proof that it was not too heavy at all. Parole was reintroduced for those who had served 2/3 of their sentence. They began paying money wages in all camps, and prisoners flooded the shops, which were subject to no prudent disciplinary restrictions. And how could they be when so many prisoners were unguarded so much of the time? Indeed, they could spend their money in the settlement, too, if they wished. All huts were wired for radio. Prisoners had more than their fill of newspapers and wall newspapers. Agitators were assigned to each work team. Comrade lecturers, colonels even, came to address the camp's population on various themes. even on The Perversion of History by Alexei Tolstoy. But the administration did not find it so easy to collect an audience. They could no longer drive them in with sticks, and subtler methods of pressure and persuasion were necessary. There was a continual buzz of private conversation in the hall, and nobody listened to the lecturers. Prisoners were permitted to subscribe to the loan, but no one except the loyalists was moved by this, and their mentors had to tug each prisoner by the hand toward the subscription list and squeeze the odd 10, 1 ruble, Khrushchev style, out of him. They started organizing joint shows for men's and women's camps on Sundays. People flocked to these willingly, and men even bought themselves ties in the camp shops. Much of the archipelago's gold reserve was put into circulation again. There was a revival of the selfless voluntary activities by which it had lived in the days of the great canals. Councils of activists were set up, with sectors like those of a local trade union committee, for industrial training, culture and recreation, and services, with the struggle for higher productivity and better discipline as their main task. Comrades' courts were recreated, with the right to censure offenders, to request disciplinary measures, or the non-application of the two-thirds rule. These measures had once served our leaders well, but that was in camps which had not gone through the special camp course in murder and mutiny. Now things were simpler. One chairman of an activist's council was murdered at Kengir, a second beaten up, and suddenly nobody wanted to join. Captain Second Class Burkovsky worked at this time in a council of activists, worked honestly and conscientiously, but because he was always being threatened with the knife, he was also very cautious and attended meetings of the Banderist Brigade to listen to criticism of his actions. And still, the pitiless blows of liberalism staggered and rocked the camp system. Light discipline camp divisions were set up. There was even one in Kengir. In effect, you need only sleep in the camp area because you went to work without escort, by any route, and at any time you pleased. Everybody, in fact, tried to set out early and return late. On Sunday, a third of the prisoners were let out on the town before dinner, a third of them after dinner, and only one-third were not allowed an outing. This does not mean that such leniency was universal. Punitive camp divisions were also preserved, like the all-union punitive camp at Anziobo, near Bratsk, with our old friend from Odzelag, the blood-stained Captain Mishin, in charge. In the summer of 1955, there were about 400 prisoners there for special punishment, Tenno among them. But even there, the prisoners, not the warders, were masters of the camp. Let the reader put himself in the position of the camp authorities and tell me, could they operate in such conditions? Could anyone expect good results? One MVD officer, my travelling companion on a Siberian train journey in 1962, described this whole era in the life of the camps until 1954 as follows. Things were completely out of hand. Those who didn't want to didn't even go to work. They bought television sets with their own money. If they didn't work, where did the money come from? If this was in the north, and in 1955 at that, where did the television sets come from? Still, I never dreamed of interrupting him. I enjoyed listening. He had retained very dark memories of that short but unpleasant period. For no good can come of it when his mentor stands before a prisoner like a suppliant, with neither whips nor punishment cells nor graded short rations to fall back on. But this was apparently still not enough. The next assault on the archipelago was with a battering ram called the off-camp, living out, system. Prisoners were allowed to move out of camp altogether to acquire houses and families. They were paid wages like free men and paid in full, with no more deductions for the upkeep of the camp, the guards, and the administration. Their only remaining link with the camp was that once a fortnight they went in to report. This was the end of the world, or of the archipelago, or of both at once. But the organs of the law applauded the off-camp system as an outstandingly humane, a pioneering discovery of the communist order. Described, we may add, together with remission for good conduct and conditional early release, by Chekhov in Sakhalin. Convicts classified as expected to reform had the right to build themselves houses and to marry. After these blows, there seemed to be nothing left but to disband the camps and be done with it, to destroy the great archipelago, ruin, scatter, and demoralize hundreds of thousands of practical workers with their wives, children, and domestic animals, make faithful service, rank, and an impeccable record things of no account. It seemed to have begun already, something called commissions of the Supreme Soviet, or more simply, unloading parties, began arriving at the camps, cold-shouldering the camp authorities, taking over the staff hut for their sessions, and writing out orders of release as light-heartedly and irresponsibly as though they were warrants for arrest. A deadly threat hung over the whole caste of practical workers. They had to think of something. They had to fight. One of two fates awaits any important social event in the USSR. Either it will be hushed up, or it will be the subject of calumny. I can think of no significant event in our country which has slipped past the roadblock. So it was throughout the existence of the archipelago. Most of the time it was hushed up, and whatever was written about it was lies, whether in the days of the great canals or about the unloading commissions of 1956. As far as these commissions were concerned, we ourselves, with no insidious prompting from the newspapers, under no pressure from outside, assisted the work of sentimental falsification. Who would not be deeply moved? We were used to attack from our own lawyers, and now we saw public prosecutors taking our side. We pined for freedom. We felt that out there a new life was beginning. We could see as much even from the changes in the camps. And suddenly there came a miracle-working plenipotentiary commission which talked to each prisoner for 5 or 10 minutes, then handed him a rail ticket and a passport. Some of them even registered for Moscow. What, except praise, could burst from the emaciated, chronically bronchitic, wheezy breasts of us prisoners? But what if we had risen for a moment above the happiness that set our hearts painfully pounding and ourselves running to stuff our rags into our duffel bags, and asked ourselves whether this was the proper ending to all Stalin's crimes? Should not the commission have stood before a general line-up of prisoners, bared their heads, and said, "Brothers, we have been sent by the Supreme Soviet to beg your forgiveness. For years and decades you have languished here, though you are guilty of nothing, while we gathered in ceremonial halls under cut-glass chandeliers with never a thought for you. We submissively confirmed the cannibals' inhuman decrees, every one of them. We are accomplices in his murders. Accept our belated repentance if you can. The gates are open and you are free. Out there on the airstrip, planes are landing with medicines, food, and warm clothing. There are doctors on board." Either way, they obtained their freedom, but this was the wrong way to confer it, a denial of its true meaning. The unloading commission was like a careful janitor following the trail of Stalin's vomit and diligently mopping it up. That was all. This was no way to lay new moral foundations for our society. I am quoting in what follows the judgment of A. Skripnikova, with which I entirely agree. Prisoners are summoned one by one, as usual to keep them disunited, into the office where the commission sits. A few factual questions are asked about each man's case. The questions are perfectly polite and apparently well-meant, but their drift is that the prisoner must admit his guilt, not the Supreme Soviet, but the unhappy prisoner again. He must be silent. He must bow his head. He must be put in the position of one forgiven, not one who forgives. In other words, they want to coax out of him with the promise of freedom what previously they could not wring from him even by torture. Why? You may ask. It is most important. He must return to freedom a timid soul. And at the same time, the commission's records will make it appear to history that those inside were, most of them, guilty, that the pictures of brutal lawlessness have been greatly overdrawn. There may have been a handsome financial benefit, too. Without rehabilitation, no compensation need be paid. Incidentally, there was a proposal at the beginning of 1955 to pay compensation for every year spent inside. This was only natural, and such payments were, in fact, being made in Eastern Europe. But not to so many people, and not for so many years. They totted it all up, and were horrified. We shall ruin the state. So they opted for 2 months' compensation. If it meant no more than this, the release of prisoners held no dangers.
It would not blow the whole camp system sky high. It created no obstacle to new admissions, which went on uninterruptedly even in 1956 to 1957, and no obligation to release the newcomers in their turn.
What of those who, out of incomprehensible pride, refused to acknowledge their guilt to the Commission? They were left inside. There were quite a few of them. Unrepentant women prisoners in Dubrovlag in 1956 were rounded up and dispatched to the Kemerovo camps. Skripnikova tells us of the following incident. One Western Ukrainian woman had been given 10 years because her husband was a supporter of Bandera. She was now called upon to admit that she was in because he was a bandit. "No, I won't say it." "Say it and you'll go free." "No, I won't say it. He's no bandit. He's in the OUN. "All right, if you don't want to go, you can stay," said Solovyov, chairman of the commission. A few days later, her husband visited her on his way home from the north. He had been sentenced to 25 years, but he readily admitted that he was a bandit and was pardoned. He showed no appreciation of his wife's staunchness and heaped reproaches on her. "Why didn't you say that I was the devil himself, that you'd seen my tail and my cloven hoof? How am I going to manage the farm and the children now?" I should mention that Skripnikova herself refused to acknowledge her guilt and remained inside another 3 years. So even the era of freedom came to the archipelago in a public prosecutor's gown. All the same, the alarm of the practical workers was not baseless. In 1955 to 1956, the stars over the archipelago were in a conjunction never seen before. These were fateful years for it, and might have been its last. If the people who were invested with supreme power and weighed down with the fullness of their knowledge about their country had also been steeped in that doctrine of theirs, but believed in it genuinely and wholeheartedly, surely those years were the time for them to look back in horror and to sob aloud. How can they gain admittance to the kingdom of communism with that bloody sack at their backs? It oozes blood. Their backs are one great crimson stain. They have let out the politicals, but who or what has produced all those millions of non-political and non-professional criminals? Our relations of production, the social milieu, we ourselves, you, perhaps. They should have let their space program go to hell, let Sukarno's navy and Kwame Nkrumah's guard regiments look after themselves. They might at least have sat down and scratched their heads. Where do we go next? Why are our laws, the best in the world, rejected by millions of our citizens? What makes them so ready to crawl under that murderous yoke? And the more intolerable it is, the more densely they flock to shoulder it. What must we do to stem the stream? Perhaps our laws are not what they should be. And here it would be worth thinking a little about the harassed schools, the neglected countryside, and all those things which we can only call injustices with no class label. How are we to bring the fallen back to life? Not by cheap and facile gestures like the Voroshilov amnesty, but by a sympathetic effort to understand each of them, his case, and his character. Should we put an end to the archipelago or not? Or is it there forever? For 40 years it has been an ulcer in our flesh, isn't that enough? Evidently not. It is not enough. Nobody wants to tire the convolutions of his brain. There is no answering ring in the soul. Let the archipelago stand for another 50 years, while we get on with the Aswan Dam and the unification of the Arabs. Historians attracted to the 10-year reign of Nikita Khrushchev, when certain physical laws to which we had grown accustomed suddenly seemed to stop operating, when objects miraculously began defying the forces in the electromagnetic field, defying the pull of gravity, will inevitably be astounded to see how many opportunities were briefly concentrated in those hands, and how playfully, how frivolously they were used before they were nonchalantly tossed aside. Endowed with greater power than anyone in our history except Stalin, a power which, though impaired, was still enormous, he used it like Krylov's Mishka in the forest clearing, rolling his log first this way, then that, and all to no purpose. He was given the chance to draw the lines of freedom 3 times, 5 times more firmly. And he failed to understand his duty, abandoned it as though it were a game, for space, for maize, for rockets in Cuba, for Berlin ultimatums, for persecution of the church, for the splitting of oblast party committees, for the battle with abstract art. He never carried anything through to its conclusion, least of all the fight for freedom. Stir him up against the intelligentsia? Nothing could have been simpler. Use his hands, the hands that wrecked Stalin's camps, to reinforce the camps now. That was easily achieved, and just think when. In 1956, the year of the 20th Congress, the first orders limiting relaxation of the camp regime were promulgated. They were extended in 1957, the year when Khrushchev achieved undivided power. But the caste of practical workers was still not satisfied. Scenting victory, they went over to the offensive. We can't go on like this. The camp system is the main prop of the Soviet regime, and it is collapsing. For the most part, their influence was, of course, brought to bear discreetly, at official banquets, in the passenger cabins of aircraft, at Dachau boating parties. But their activities sometimes came out into the open, as, for instance, in B.I. Samsonov's speech at a session of the Supreme Soviet, December 1958. Prisoners, said he, live too well. They are satisfied with their food, whereas they should be permanently dissatisfied. They are treated too well. In a parliament which had never acknowledged its earlier guilt, no one, of course, rebuked Samsonov, or in the article about the man behind bars, 1960. Yielding to this pressure, without examining anything closely, without pausing to reflect that crime had not increased in those last 5 years, or that if it had, the causes must be sought in the political system, without considering how these new measures could be squared with his faith in the triumphal advance of communism, or attempting to study the matter in detail, or even to look at it with his own eyes, this Tsar, who had spent all his life on the road, light-heartedly signed the order for nails to knock the scaffold together again quickly, in its old shape and as sturdy as ever. And all this happened in the very year, 1961, when Nikita made his last expiring effort to tug the cart of freedom up into the clouds. It was in 1961, the year of the 22nd Congress, that a decree was promulgated on the death penalty in the camps for terrorist acts against reformed prisoners, in other words, stoolies, and against supervisory staff, something which had never happened. And the plenum of the Supreme Court confirmed, in June 1961, regulations for 4 disciplinary categories in camps. Khrushchev's camps now, not Stalin's. When he climbed onto the Congress platform for another attack on Stalin's tyranny, Nikita had only just allowed the screws of his very own system to be turned no less tight. And he sincerely believed that all this could be fitted together and made consistent. The camps today are as approved by the party before the 22nd Congress. 6 years later, they are just as they were then. They differ from Stalin's camps not in regime, but in the composition of their population. There are no longer millions and millions of 58s. But there are still millions inside, and just as before, many of them are helpless victims of perverted justice, swept in simply to keep the system operating and well-fed. Rulers change. The archipelago remains. It remains because that particular political regime could not survive without it. If it disbanded the archipelago, it would cease to exist itself. Every story must have an end. It must be broken off somewhere. To the best of our modest and inadequate ability, we have followed the history of the archipelago, from the crimson volleys which greeted its birth to the pink mists of rehabilitation. In the glorious period of leniency and disarray on the eve of Khrushchev's measures to make the camps harsher again, on the eve of a new criminal code, let us consider our story ended. Other historians will appear, historians who, to their sorrow, know the Khrushchev and post-Khrushchev camps better than we do. 2 have, in fact, appeared already, S. Karavansky and Anatoly Marchenko. And they will float to the surface in great numbers, because soon, very soon, the era of publicity will arrive in Russia. Marchenko's book, for instance, fills with pain and horror even the heart of an old camp hand, inured to suffering as it is. In its description of prison conditions today, it gives us a jail of a still newer type than the one of which my own witnesses speak. We learn that the horn, the second horn of imprisonment, see Part 1, Chapter 12, juts more boldly, sticks in the prisoner's neck more sharply than ever. By comparing the buildings of the Vladimir Central Prison, the Tsarist and the Soviet buildings, Marchenko shows concretely where the analogy with the Tsarist period of Russian history breaks down. The Tsarist building is dry and warm, the Soviet building damp and cold. Your ears may get frostbitten in your cell. Padded jackets are never taken off. The windows of the Tsarist building are blocked with four layers of Soviet bricks. And don't forget the muzzles. The NKVD men are a power in the land, and they will never give way of their own free will. If they stood their ground in 1956, they can certainly hold out a bit longer. It isn't just the corrective labor organs. It isn't just the Ministry for the Protection of Public Order. We have seen already how eagerly newspapers and deputies to the Supreme Soviet support them. Because they are the backbone of so many things. They have strength, but that is not all. They have arguments, too. Debate with them is not so easy. I have tried it. Not that I ever meant to, but those letters drove me to it. Letters from today's natives which took me completely by surprise. The natives looked at me in hope and begged me to tell their story, to defend them, to make them human again. But tell whom? Supposing that anyone will listen to me? If we had a free press, I would publish all this. There, it's all out in the open. Now let's discuss it. As things are at present, January 1964, I wander around the corridors of institutions, a secret and timid suppliant. Bow my head to the hatches through which passes are issued, feel upon myself the disapproving and suspicious stare of the soldiers on duty. How hard a writer and commentator on public affairs must work before busy government officials will do him the honour, will condescend to lend him an ear for half an hour. But even this is not the greatest difficulty. My greatest difficulty is just what it was all that time ago at the four men's meeting in Ekibastutz. What can I talk to them about, and in what language? To speak any of my real thoughts as set out in this book would be both dangerous and completely hopeless. Why lose my head in the hushed privacy of an inner office, unheard by the public, unbeknown to all those who long to hear it, and without advancing the cause a single millimetre? How, then, can I speak? As I cross their mirror-like marble thresholds, go up their softly carpeted stairways, I must voluntarily trammel myself with silken threads drawn through my tongue, my ears, my eyelids, and then stitched to my shoulders, the skin of my back, and my belly. I must, at the very least, voluntarily accept two things. One, all praise to the party for our whole past, present, and future, which means that our general penal policy cannot be wrong. I dare not express my doubts as to whether the archipelago need ever have existed, and I must not maintain that the majority are inside for no good reason. Two, the high-ranking personages with whom I shall be talking are dedicated to their work and concerned for the prisoners. They must not be accused of insincerity, coldness, or ignorance. If a man puts his whole heart into a job, how can he possibly not know all about it? Much more dubious are my motives in interfering. What am I up to? Why me, when I have no official duty to perform? Perhaps I have some dirty ends of my own. Why must I meddle, when the party sees everything, and will get it all right with no assistance from me? To make my position look a little stronger, I choose the month of my nomination for a Lenin Prize, and I make my move like a pawn of some importance. He may yet go up in the world and become a rook. Supreme Soviet of the USSR Legislative Proposals Commission. I discover that it has been engaged for some years in drafting a new corrective labor code, a code that is to govern the whole future life of the archipelago, replacing the 1933 code, which existed and yet never existed, which might as well never have been written. and now they have arranged to see me so that I, an alumnus of the archipelago, can acquaint myself with their wisdom and put before them my own trumpery notions. They are 8 in number. 4 of them are surprisingly young, boys who may just about have had time to complete their higher education, and then again may not. How quickly they are rising to positions of power. They look so much at home in this marble-floored palace to which I was admitted with great precautions. The chairman of the commission is Ivan Andreevich Badukhin, an elderly man who seems infinitely good-natured. His looks seem to say that if it depended on him, he would disband the archipelago tomorrow. But his role is this, to take a back seat and say nothing throughout our conversation. The real beasts of prey are 2 little old men, just like those old men in Griboyedov, who remembered Ochakov taken and Tartary subdued, set fast in postures adopted long ago. I will take my oath that they have not even opened a newspaper since March the 5th, 1953, so sure is it that nothing capable of influencing their views can ever happen. One of them wears a blue coat, and I imagine that it is some sort of uniform worn at Catherine's court. I can even distinguish the mark left when he unpinned Catherine's silver star, which must have half-covered his chest. Both old men totally disapprove of me and my visit from the moment I crossed the threshold, but they are determined to make a show of tolerance. It's never harder to speak than when you have too much to say. Besides, I have all these threads stitched on to me, and I feel them with every movement I make. Still, I have my main harangue ready, and I anticipate no painful tugs at the strings. I speak as follows. Where does the idea come from? I pretend to assume that it is not theirs. That the prison camps are in danger of becoming health resorts, and that unless a camp is garrisoned by cold and hunger, blessed ease will enthrone itself there. I ask them, in spite of their defective personal experience, to try and imagine the densely ringed stockade of privations and punishments, which is the reality of imprisonment. A man is deprived of his native place. He lives with men with whom he has no wish to live. He wants to live with his family and friends, but cannot. He does not see his children growing up. He is deprived of his normal surroundings, his home, his belongings, right down to his wristwatch. His name is disgraced and forgotten. He is deprived of freedom of movement, denied as a rule even the possibility of working at his own trade. He feels the constant pressure of strangers, some of them hostile to him, of other prisoners, whose background, outlook, and habits are different from his. Denied the softening influence of the other sex, not to mention the physical deprivation, and even the medical attention he gets is incomparably poorer. In what way does all this resemble a Black Sea sanatorium? Why are they so much afraid of the health resort jibe? No, this thought doesn't bowl them over. They aren't rocked in their chairs by it. So, I broaden my theme. Do we or do we not want to restore these people to society? If we do, why do we make them live like outcasts? Why is the whole content of our disciplinary regimes the systematic humiliation and physical exhaustion of prisoners? What advantage is it to the state to make cripples of them? So, I've unburdened myself. And they start showing me where I am wrong. I have no real idea of what the present contingent is like. I judge from old impressions. I'm behind the times. Yes, this is my weak spot. I cannot indeed see who is inside now. For habitual criminals sentenced to close confinement, all the things in my list are no privation at all. The present disciplinary regimes are the only thing that can teach them sense. 2 painful jerks at my strings. They are the experts here. They know best who is inside. This book is continued on cassette 15, side 1.